Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative Call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions following the presentation. Please note this call is being recorded. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Anne Wendland. Anne, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Erin. Good afternoon. This is Anne Wendland, the Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I'd like to welcome you to today's call, Treating Tobacco Use and Dependence, a focus on the pharmacotherapy options. If you have not downloaded the slides for today, presentations and eventually all call recordings are posted on the collaborative call page of the New York State Smokers Quit site at nysmokefree.com. From the website's front page, click on the Healthcare Providers and Partners tab, and then choose Collaborative Call. Click on the link for more information on the upcoming and past calls to find the presentations. Our featured speaker today is Dr. Nicole Odis. She is an Associate Professor of Pharmacy Practice at Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. She's an Adjunct Associate Professor with the Department of Medical Education at Albany Medical College, and a clinical pharmacist at Albany Medical Center OBGYN Clinic, Tobacco Cessation Inpatient Services. On today's call, Dr. Lodice will discuss the paraphysiology of tobacco addiction and the recommended treatment approach. She'll also review pharmacotherapy options and counseling strategies to assist a tobacco user in his quit process. But before we start, I have some housekeeping items. We're pleased to offer CME, CRC, CE and OASS continuing education credits to listeners of today's presentation. To fulfill the requirements of the continuing ed, I'm required to disclose the following. Dr. Lodice has no real or perceived vested interest that relates to the presentation, nor does she have any relationships with pharmaceutical companies and or any other corporations, products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. To obtain continuing ed credit, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which are posted on the website, nysmokefree.com. Please remember, applications for credit will not be accepted after July 4th. That is 1 week from today, so please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible to receive credit. Now it is my pleasure to turn the call over to Dr. Nicole Lodice. Dr. Lodice?
Thank you so much. So welcome, everyone, and thank you all of you for participating and attending today's call. So just to highlight and reinforce and kind of get us started today, we do have three core objectives that we're really going to be focusing on, taking a look at the pathophysiology of tobacco addiction, as well as doing a quick review on the recommended treatment approach. We're also going to take a look specifically for the bulk of the call, the pharmacotherapy options. And given the time that we have, I really wanted to focus in on some of the dosing, administration, and some of those common counseling points that are advantageous when talking to your patients about the options that are available. And then finally, to wrap things up, we'll talk about, as clinicians, how can we ask our patients about tobacco use, advise our patients to quit, especially in the busy environments that we all are working in. So to get us started, you know, why should all of us, as clinicians, focus on tobacco cessation with our patients? Well, certainly we see it's the single most effective strategy to lengthen and improve patients' lives. We see both acute as well as long-term benefits for all of our patients. And it really comes down to, as healthcare professionals, it's inconsistent if we are not providing that message back to our patients. So it really is a significant component of patient care. Now, when we look at addiction specifically, the definition, basic definition of addiction, compulsive drug use without medical purpose in the face of negative consequences. And we look a little bit more specifically at addiction and the role of dopamine, one of the core neurotransmitters involved in addiction. And when we think about addiction, nicotine addiction specifically, it is more than just a bad habit. One of the core neurotransmitters, as I highlighted, is dopamine that is involved in nicotine addiction. It is considered kind of that pleasurable neurotransmitter. So what happens when a patient smokes a cigarette? Nicotine is stimulating this rush of dopamine release. So it's giving that patient those pleasurable feelings. So what happens when someone does something, they feel good, they want to do it again. So you have that repeat administration. Over time, tolerance is beginning to develop. We need more nicotine. We need more cigarettes, for example, to get that same or achieve that same effect that they were once able to achieve, maybe with only a few. And as we really kind of get into some of the different pharmacotherapy options, we'll also touch on briefly the mechanism of action. You'll certainly see how that dopamine is really involved in terms of each of our pharmacotherapy options. Now, when we look at tobacco use behavior, there really is three different components associated with tobacco use behavior. We have the addictive piece, the physical addiction, your body's need or craving for that nicotine. The habit, so thinking about our patients, you know, those daily associations, part of that daily routine when they're smoking those cigarettes. And then finally, the psychological dependence. And we're going to kind of just touch on these very briefly just as a refresher. So getting us started with the addiction piece. And again, this really is the physical addiction. It highlights your body's, you know, physical need, physical craving for that nicotine. And suddenly if we take that cigarette away, for example, this is what results in those withdrawal symptoms. So this is really the piece, the component of tobacco use behavior where the pharmacotherapy options really play a key role in targeting these withdrawal symptoms and helping to reduce that physical addiction. We also see the habit component has another key component, and I'll be honest, kind of from an anecdotal perspective, over the number of years that I have talked to patients about trying to assist them in the quit process, this tends to be one of the most challenging aspects, I think, of the quit process for many smokers. This is really those unconscious urges, part of the daily routine. In the car, with their morning coffee, after meals, at bedtime, those normal automatic associations that they're having in terms of when they may or may not be picking up that cigarette. And then finally, taking a look at the psychological dependence. And this really comes down to kind of the mistaken belief or misconception that patients have that the cigarette, for example, is doing something positive for them. And probably two of the most common that we tend to hear is stress relief and helping patients maintain a healthy weight. I don't know how many times I hear that from patients of, well, I'm smoking to relieve my stress. The stress isn't going to go away, so the cigarette helps me to maintain my stress. It also helps to keep my weight in check. And as we know, many times it is the other factors, the other behaviors perhaps that patients are partaking in that is actually helping to decrease their stress or manage their weight, not necessarily that cigarette specifically. So when we look at and understanding the behaviors associated with tobacco use, how do we now want to approach our patients and what options do we have available? So the two most recent guidelines that we have the 2000 as well as the 2008 clinical practice guideline updates. So just to kind of bring us back as a refresher, looking at the 2000 practice guidelines, they promoted the 5 A's, the 5 R's has the key approach for our patients. They also highlighted medications as well as behavioral changes to assist in the quit process. And at that point, we had our 5 first line options. So we're going to come back to the 2008 guidelines in a moment, but just as a quick refresher, let's take a look at the 5 A's and the 5 R's. So 5 A's, asking your patient, are you a current tobacco user? Are you interested in quitting smoking? Advising, here's the risks of tobacco use, here's the benefits of quitting. Assessing, where exactly is my patient? You can utilize the trans-theoretical model, the stages of change, or our non-trans-theoretical model. So is my patient not ready, or a recent quitter? And then assisting the patient, and then arranging for follow-up. So the 5 A's really is something that we utilized to initiate with all patients, and then specifically for those patients that tend to be ready to quit or motivated to quit. For our unmotivated patients, we switch gears and look at the 5 R's. So relevance, the risks of tobacco use, the rewards of quitting, roadblocks or barriers, as well as the repetition. So even as unmotivated of a patient that you may be interacting with may seem, we still want to be repetitive in terms of our interactions with that patient. So taking a look now, again, back at the 2008 guidelines, they still reinforce those 5 A's and 5 R's approach, again, highlighting the importance of counseling, so the behavioral counseling, and the use of medications. And then at that point, we had now 7 first-line options. This included the addition of the nicotine lozenge as well as varenicline. And the biggest change, really, I think, as all of us are aware, the biggest change, really, I think, with the 2000 compared to 2008 guidelines was the approach to special populations. So when we look at our special populations, we have our pregnant patients, our light smokers, individuals smoking less than 10 cigarettes per day, as well as adolescents smoking less or individuals less than 18 years of age. And the recommendation really from the 2008 guidelines, to sum it up, was to utilize counseling cessation interventions rather than the medications to assist in the QIP process. And I think kind of the biggest disclaimer to this really is the fact that this was not due to an increase of literature highlighting risk or benefit, but really just due to a lack of published data in some of these specialty groups. So let's take a look. I tried to incorporate a couple of different cases for us to have as much kind of interactive discussion, hopefully, as possible, even though I can't see all of you. So let's start out with our first patient case. We have JS, who's a 30-year-old Caucasian female who comes to your clinic for a follow-up visit. She is currently 8 weeks pregnant. Past medical history as well as social history is significant for tobacco use. She smokes about 1 pack per day and has done so for about 7 years. She reports that she has never tried to quit in the past, but is interested in quitting now that she is pregnant. JS has identified 1 week from today as her quit date. So what is your recommended treatment approach for JS today? So A, encourage JS to wait until her second trimester to quit. B, discuss behavioral strategies as the primary quit approach. C, initiate varenicline. Or D, initiate NRT in addition to behavioral strategies. And I did try to keep this somewhat vague for a reason. So really, if we kind of take a look at this, given she does smoke about 1 pack per day, you know, you may be thinking, all right, what, you know, how do I want to even start this? What should we be thinking about taking into consideration some of the guidelines? So probably your initial maybe go-to answer would most likely be B, keeping us in line with the guidelines, discussing behavioral strategies as the primary quit approach initially. As I mentioned, given she does smoke 1 pack per day, it may be challenging. However, let's say she tries initially to quit just with behavioral strategies, but it may be challenging given she does smoke a pack per day. So if that doesn't work with just trying behavioral strategies initially, D could potentially be another possible answer. I try not to do this when I give exams as a faculty member. I try to only have one answer, but I think for point of discussion, it's helpful to kind of show a little bit of progression. So if it's something where she tries behavioral strategies initially with B and that doesn't work and the patient is likely or tending to relapse, we could explore D has another option. So initiating nicotine replacement therapies in addition to behavioral strategies. Ultimately, though, this would be based on clinician as well as patient-specific characteristics. So the guidelines are really, just as they state, they are a guide for many clinicians, I think, across the board. It gives us a starting point. So many times, like this patient, we can start her off. We know that she's pregnant. Let's try her, keeping in line with the guidelines of just trying that approach of behavioral strategies. And if we're finding that she's having more slips, increasing likelihood for relapse, then we could explore the use of medications in addition to behavioral strategies. Now, just to kind of put a recent evidence spin on this, there's actually been a recent article, many of you may be aware of it, by a group called Coleman and Colleagues, and it was actually included within the March issue of New England Journal of Medicine. And it actually evaluated the use of the nicotine patch in addition to behavioral strategies versus a placebo patch in addition to behavioral strategies. It was an 8-week long study. The results actually showed a significant difference in favor of the nicotine patch at about 1 month. But after that, there was actually no difference between our intervention group of getting the nicotine patch compared to the placebo group. And again, both groups were given behavioral strategies. So there was actually two possible rationales that were highlighted within this study as potential reasoning for this. The first potential was perhaps there's a decrease in adherence with this type of patient population in our pregnant patients. And decreasing adherence, patients aren't utilizing the patches or stop using the patches, that can lead to an increased risk for relapse. Another potential rationale that was highlighted based on this study was that some of the standard dosing was certainly used in this trial, but may not be adequate. There is increased metabolism of nicotine during pregnancy, so there's certainly a need for exploring if potentially higher doses may be warranted in terms of keeping those nicotine withdrawal symptoms and cravings in check. Ultimately, it's something where we still need more data. We still need more evidence to really explore this further. Taking a look and switching gears to the targets associated with pregnancy, or excuse me, targets associated with tobacco cessation. And again, what we've already highlighted, the environment, the habit, the psychological piece, as well as the physical addiction. And we're going to really kind of be targeting, when we think about tobacco cessation, our goal really is to target each of these components with tobacco use behavior. And we really want to focus in on the physical addiction piece for the remaining portion of the call, and specifically getting into some of the product-specific considerations for each of our tobacco cessation treatment agents. So getting us started with our nicotine replacement therapies first, and we have, again, 7 different approved options, our nicotine replacement therapies, bupropion, as well as varenicline. So to start us out with the nicotine replacement therapies, the core mechanism of action for this group really is to replace the nicotine that patients are typically getting from, for example, smoking a cigarette. So we are trying to reduce those withdrawal symptoms. We're trying to allow patients to keep that physical addiction in check, so they can focus more on the behavioral and psychological aspects of tobacco use. When we think about the efficacy associated with our NRT therapies, they typically are able to double those abstinence rates. So we do see efficacy that these products do work. To talk about some of the product-specific considerations, and we'll get us started with the nicotine gum first. We have several different options available, so certainly the gum has come a long way in terms of the number of options available to our patients. We have 2 dosing options for our patients, our 2-milligram dose as well as the 4-milligram dose. Typically, when we think about the dosing for the nicotine gum, it is based on the number of cigarettes that a patient smokes. So for a patient that smokes a pack or more a day, typically would start out with a 4-milligram. A patient that is smoking less than a pack could start out with a 2-milligram dose. And then again, there is a wide variety of different flavors available for patients. 2 of the most significant counseling points that I always like to point out when we think about the nicotine gum specifically. The first one really has to do with the dosing schedule, as highlighted by the next slide. When the nicotine gum is used as a monotherapy, it really is important that it is taken and utilized on this scheduled basis. I think what happens very commonly with patients is, you know, if they have reported utilizing the gum before and they mention, you know, it didn't work, or it really didn't help in reducing cravings, it just didn't seem to work well for them in a quit attempt, I think it definitely warrants asking the patient, well, how are you using the gum? How are you taking the gum? And I think what many times tends to happen with patients is, well, they use it when they're getting a craving. And that's certainly something that we want to advise patients to not do. We want them to take it on a scheduled basis, every 1 to 2 hours, every 2 to 4, every 4 to 8 hours, especially, again, when it's the monotherapy, when it's the only option patients are using, so we have consistent levels of nicotine. throughout the day. And that will help to minimize those withdrawal symptoms and hopefully keep that patient on track for success towards abstinence. Another key counseling point with the gum is really the administration associated with the gum. And we use the park and chew technique. Again, when we think about the gum, what oftentimes happens with patients, if they're not meeting with a healthcare professional to talk about the administration, they pick it up, they've tried it, they mention it to you as part of their previous quit attempts and say, that one really didn't work well. Well, how exactly did you use the gum? Well, I put it into my mouth and I chewed it like a regular piece of gum. Again, the flag should kind of go off in our minds at that point as clinicians to say, well, typically we want to use the park and chew method. So biting on the gum a few times, you release that peppery sensation. That's the nicotine being released. At that point, they can park it on either side of their mouth and allowing for that nicotine to begin absorption. So they actually don't want to chew it like a regular piece of gum, biting it a few times and then parking it. Once that peppery sensation goes away, they bite it again and then rotate it again throughout their mouth. With the nicotine gum, the way that the nicotine is actually being absorbed is through buccal absorption. So it's actually being absorbed through the mouth, the lining of the mouth. And it's actually buffered for buccal absorption. So another counseling point along the same lines with this is to avoid eating or drinking when they're actually using the gum and for 15 minutes before. So avoiding any of those acidic types of beverages, soda, coffee, wines, anything that can decrease the amount of nicotine that can actually be absorbed. Switching gears to the nicotine lozenge. And the lozenge is very similar to the gum in terms of dosing as well as some of the different counseling points that we're going to highlight. So again, the lozenge comes in two doses, 2 milligram as well as a 4 milligram, just like the gum. Dosing for the lozenge typically is based on time to first cigarette. So if a patient is having their first cigarette within 30 minutes, they could utilize the 4 milligram dosing. If a patient is able to go beyond 30 minutes within waking, they would go and utilize the 2 milligram gum. So it's really based on that first cigarette of the day. How much time do they have between when waking and picking up that first milligram, really highlighting their level of nicotine dependence. So again, within 30 minutes, they would go with the 4 milligram. More than 30 minutes, they could go with the 2 milligram. When we think about some of the counseling points, again, transitioning to the next slide in terms of the dosing schedule, it's going to be, again, very similar to the gum. So we want to, if this is the only option that the patient is currently utilizing, again, it's the monotherapy that we're using, we want to make sure that patients are using it on a scheduled basis, as highlighted on this slide, rather than just taking it when they need it, when they're having a craving. That's going to increase the chance for success. And it also is buffered. So again, we're thinking about that buccal absorption. So making sure that they're not eating or drinking 15 minutes before and while they're actually utilizing the lozenge. And then just avoiding those acidic types of beverages, coffee, soda, wine, anything that's going to decrease the amount of nicotine that can be absorbed. Taking a look at the nicotine patch, the nicotine is well absorbed across the skin, and we do see that, and it provides very consistent nicotine levels. It also, from a compliance standpoint, it allows once daily dosing. Patients are on the patch first thing in the morning, and they don't have to worry about it for the rest of the day. So really, from a compliance standpoint, this does provide a great option for our patients. We do have step-down dosing, so taking a look at the next line, typical dosings, we have our 3 strengths, our 21 milligram, our 14 milligram, and a 7 milligram. And this, per the package insert, really just provides a guidance in terms of the time frame to utilize each of these patch strengths. But there certainly can be some room for variability from one patient to the next. So typically we recommend 21 milligram, that first step for 6 weeks, stepping down for the 14 for another 2 weeks, and then the 7 for another 2 weeks. But I have certainly had patients, let's say, that are on the 14 milligram, and at the end of 2 weeks, they don't really feel ready to step down. They feel like they want to, you know, they're not maybe from a habit perspective or psychological, even just from an addiction perspective, they feel that they need one more week. That's perfectly reasonable to tweak that, keep them on that step for another week before stepping down. Another two probably key counseling points that oftentimes can come up with your patients when we think about the nicotine patch. One of the common ones just tends to be those local skin reactions. So sometimes patients can have some skin irritation, and many times that's secondary to the adhesive. Certainly a reasonable solution to that would be to switch brands or switch to a generic option. So trying some different options because certainly there will be different adhesives depending on the brand that the patient is actually using. Another option or another kind of counseling point, discussion point for your patients when it comes to the patch, many patients may report vivid dreams when they are utilizing the patch. So the patch is utilized 24 hours a day. They apply it in the morning. They keep it on for the full 24 hours, and the next day they would remove that patch and replace a new patch in a different location. If you have a patient that is experiencing vivid dreams and it becomes bothersome to them, it is certainly perfectly reasonable to have that patient take the patch off before they go to bed at night, and then the next morning put on a brand new patch. This way they're not wearing any patch through the course of the evening when they're sleeping. So transitioning to our next nicotine replacement therapy option. Now, just to highlight, our first three options, the gum, the lozenge, as well as the patch, are all available over-the-counter options. As we transition and talk about our last two nicotine replacement therapy options, the nasal spray, and then finally we'll touch on the nicotine inhaler, both of these options are available through a prescription. So looking specifically at the nasal spray, with each spray that is released, it actually releases about 0.5 milligrams of nicotine. So it does require or need patients to utilize multiple sprays throughout the day. So there's more frequent dosing associated with the nicotine nasal spray. Typically, patients are using about 8 doses per day. So what actually equals a dose? So one dose is one spray in each nostril. So in each spray, again, we're getting about 0.5 milligrams of nicotine. And then one dose, one spray in each nostril. Overall, we're getting about 1 milligram of nicotine. So typically we start patients out with about 8 doses per day. That's kind of an initial starting dose. Sometimes it may be 9, 10, but usually we want to start them out at a minimum of about 8 doses per day. One of the biggest advantages with the nasal spray is the fact that patients can certainly and easily usually titrate their nasal spray use to manage their withdrawal symptoms, to keep their cravings in check. As I mentioned on the previous slide, you know, certainly there is a need for frequent dosing associated with the nasal spray, so sometimes that can be considered a disadvantage from a patient perspective. From a common side effect counseling perspective as well, some patients can experience some nasal irritation, some throat irritation. Typically, that tends to be transient, usually goes away within anywhere from 1 to 3 weeks after use. Typically, patients are able to tolerate it pretty well by that point, but certainly something that we just want to make patients aware of as well. And then taking a look at our final nicotine replacement therapy option, we have the nicotine inhaler. And this is really certainly, I think, kind of an advantage and disadvantage from the fact that it looks almost like a mock cigarette. So it does provide that hand-to-mouth routine for patients, especially, and I'll say kind of from an anecdotal perspective, I've had patients that have tried to quit other ways, and that was really kind of the big issue for them in terms of relapsing. And this presented a nice option in terms of helping to ease that limitation. Now they had something that they could put in their hands, similar to a cigarette. It basically comes as a nicotine cartridge that has about 10 milligrams of nicotine, but actually delivers close to 4 milligrams of nicotine. Similar to the nasal spray, Patients should use anywhere from 6 to 8 cartridges per day initially. So as I just mentioned, it does mimic that hand-to-mouth routine, so that certainly can be thought of as an advantage and a disadvantage. Similar to the nasal spray, though, it does allow that flexibility for titrating how much cartridges, how many cartridges they're utilizing to keep their withdrawal symptoms, to keep their cravings in check. When the cartridge is actually inserted into the device, it is active for 24 hours. But how much activity or how much puffing they're actually able to get off of that particular cartridge is it provides them about 20 minutes of active puffing. So they insert the cartridge into the plastic device. It's good now for 24 hours, and they are able to obtain about 20 minutes of active puffing of that nicotine, so obtaining that 4 milligrams of nicotine off of it. It does provide great flexibility for our patients. So you can have a patient that can puff on it for about 5 minutes or so, put it down, go off and do several other things, come back several hours later. They still have another 15 minutes of active puffing off of that cartridge. So it's not something that they have to do 20 minutes in one shot at one time. Transitioning to case two at this point. So now that we've wrapped up with talking about touching on each of our nicotine replacement therapies, let's take a look at case two. So we have LW, is a 64-year-old Caucasian male, admitted to the hospital for a myocardial infarction. Past medical history, hyperlipidemia, tobacco use, 1 to 1.5 packs per day for the past 49 years. Current medications, he's on simvastatin, 40 milligrams at bedtime, daily multivitamin. Patient, however, does report difficulty remembering to take his medications. LW reports he is interested in quitting, utilizing one of the over-the-counter options. He does identify his quit date as his birthday, 3.5 weeks from today. And he is concerned since his wife is also a smoker. So taking a look at what we would recommend, so thinking about, you know, what is your recommended pharmacotherapy option for LW today? We have A, nicotine patch, 21 milligrams, B, the nicotine gum at 4 milligrams, C, the nicotine lozenge at 4 milligrams, or D, bupropion 150 milligrams by mouth twice a day. So taking a look back at some of the previous kind of background that we have for our patient. Patient is interested in quitting about 3.5 weeks from today. So we certainly have a couple of different options that we can look at. Now, the patient does have some compliance issues and reports that he's looking for an over-the-counter option. So initially, taking a look at our options, A, B, or C would probably be the initial options to go to because he's looking for an over-the-counter option. He also highlights that he has some compliance issues, so he has some difficulty remembering to take his medications. So thinking about a couple of the key points that we mentioned is going through some of the different nicotine replacement therapies, based on our options here, probably A, or the nicotine patch, would be the likely or the ideal initial choice. Now, just to note, it is important to keep in mind that we do have certain precautions when it comes to the use of nicotine replacement therapies in some specific considerations. So we think about our patients that are within the previous 2 weeks of experiencing an MI, myocardial infarction, which is what our patient is in the hospital for. Patients that have unstable angina or patients that have serious arrhythmias, each of these are considered precautions for nicotine replacement therapy. So ultimately, what we're trying to wait for is for the patient to be stabilized. Now, I will say, just for kind of point of clarification, we do see, and based on several reviews and literature, it is believed that the risks of nicotine replacement therapies in these types of patient populations is small compared to the risk of having that patient continue tobacco use. So we put it in perspective in terms of our patient. They're interested in quitting. He's thinking about 3.5 weeks from now. So it's beyond that 2-week initial window where we have that precaution. And typically what we tend to do within our tobacco cessation inpatient, our hospital-based service, is we typically still would advise, for example, a patient like this to follow up with their provider to obtain kind of that provider okay, as well as keeping them in the loop prior to starting even an over-the-counter option, which is something that he is specifically interested in about 3.5 weeks. So that would be kind of the initial recommendation, but again, making sure that his provider is still in the loop at that point. So switching gears to our final two options for tobacco cessation treatments and our final two non-nicotine options, and we'll get started with bupropion first. So with bupropion, it is our atypical antidepressant for a long time. This was kind of the one non-nicotine option that was on the block, that was on the option list for our patients. Essentially, we're able to inhibit the rate uptake of dopamine and norepinephrine. We talked about the importance of dopamine earlier in the slides. When we think about the role, again, for bupropion, it's able to decrease those cravings for cigarettes, as well as keeping those withdrawal symptoms in check. When we look at the efficacy, similar to our nicotine replacement therapies, we see a doubling of those abstinence rates associated with utilizing bupropion. In terms of dosing, typically it is advised to start bupropion about 1 to 2 weeks prior to the quit date, and the primary rationale for that is to allow those bupropion levels to become therapeutic. So again, patients will initiate once daily dosing and then increase to 150 milligrams twice a day. Two of the most common symptoms that patients, common side effects that patients can experience tend to be insomnia as well as dry mouth. Now, the insomnia is one of those counseling points that we always like to make sure that we're advising patients when they're taking that second dose. If they are experiencing insomnia, it's helpful to make a double check with the patient of when exactly are they taking that second dose. So they do want to be taking that second dose a few hours prior to bedtime. You certainly want to advise the patient against taking it just at bedtime, because that will certainly increase the risk for insomnia. We also have certainly a recommended precaution counseling point with patients, although it's a smaller risk, certainly to use bupropion in caution with patients with a history of seizure. But again, the seizure incidence typically is only about less than 1% within our patients. And then to transition to our final tobacco cessation treatment option of varenicline, we'll take a look specifically at the mechanism of action associated with varenicline. This is a nicotinic receptor partial agonist, so it partially binds to that nicotinic receptor to stimulate low levels of dopamine. So again, we're having that activity with dopamine. This is able to decrease the cravings for cigarettes, as well as decreasing symptoms of nicotine withdrawal. In terms of efficacy, we have seen some variability, anywhere from doubling to tripling of abstinence rates associated with varenicline use in tobacco cessation treatment. And then we think about dosing associated with varenicline. Typically, patients are advised to start their varenicline about 1 week prior to their quit date. Unlike with bupropion, the primary rationale for this is to decrease some of the nausea-related symptoms associated with varenicline. So typically, patients start out with 0.5 milligrams daily for the first 3 days, and they increase to 0.5 milligrams twice a day, getting up to our overall dose for the full treatment of 1 milligram twice a day. And what I did was want to mention kind of as a point of clarification for all of the options are NRTs, as well as bupropion, as well as varenicline. All of these options really are typically recommended for approximately 12-week duration for most. Some may be a little less, but typical duration of treatment for any of our tobacco cessation treatment options is going to be about a 12-week time frame. So I did want to spend a little bit of time taking a look at certainly the warnings that come into play when we talk about bupropion as well as varenicline. Varenicline, even more specifically, we've seen a lot of information in the news, so I think it warrants spending a little bit of time on it, because certainly I think from a patient perspective, these questions may likely come up. So Although these medications, both bupropion and varenicline, are certainly efficacious in assisting our patients with quitting, we know that there is risk associated with them. And specifically, some of these risks include those neuropsychiatric symptoms. So changes in behavior, hostility, agitation, suicidal thoughts and behavior, or attempted suicide. So ultimately, the risk and benefit has to really be weighed. So it has to be patient-specific prior to use with either of these different medications. Now, regarding varenicline specifically, there's been some articles recently highlighting some additional risks. The first article, there was an article by Singh as well as Ferber and colleagues, and within this article was a meta-analysis, and it highlighted an increased risk of cardiovascular events associated with varenicline. What we now see secondary to this article and evidence really has been an update in the varenicline label. So now we have an increased risk of cardiovascular events highlighted in the labeling in patients with existing cardiovascular disease. Another article, more in colleagues, and as you transition to the next slide, this was an article that examined the significance of varenicline's neuropsychiatric symptoms. And what they were able to find was that varenicline actually demonstrated a statistically significant increase in reported depression, suicide, as well as self-injurious behavior. The slide that I have here highlighted on number slide 45 is just taking a piece from the article in comparison of varenicline and bupropion, looking at it or comparing it to nicotine replacement therapy in terms of these factors, in terms of increased risk of depression, reported depression, suicide, or self-injurious behaviors. We have an odds ratio for varenicline of about 8.4 overall and bupropion of about 2.9. So we are seeing an increased risk of some of these factors, certainly higher in varenicline compared to our other tobacco cessation treatments. So for either of these options, and specifically when we're talking about varenicline, it is an effective option for our patients, but I think it's something that we may need to be, as clinicians, maybe more selective in the types of patients that would warrant use of varenicline based on some of this literature that we are seeing and this information that is available. So it may be at this time that varenicline is appropriate, except if a patient has comorbid psychiatric or cardiovascular issues. Ultimately, though, it really will be patient and provider specific in terms of what's going to be the most appropriate plan of action for a patient. Taking a look specifically at combination treatments. So, you know, we've talked about when we mentioned about the gum, when we mentioned about the lozenge, I highlighted when those options are used as monotherapy. So typically when we initiate our treatment plan for our patient, we try to initiate, start them out with monotherapy if that's going to work based on how much, for example, cigarettes they are using or they are smoking. However, some patients warrant combination therapy right off the bat, or some patients start with monotherapy and it's not providing adequate relief of their cravings, or it's increasing, they're still having withdrawal symptoms. Those are going to be the patients that we really need to think about combination treatments. Per the guidelines, we do have some recommended options, the patch in addition to the gum, the nasal spray or the inhaler, the patch as well as bupropion. But a common theme with each of these combination products is there's really kind of more of a longer-acting option. For example, the patch releasing consistent levels, and then you have more of a shorter acting option on top of it. It's almost similar to a pain management approach to touch on those breakthrough cravings that patients may experience throughout the day. Ultimately, our goal is to customize our treatment plans with our patients. Taking a look at case number 3. So JM is a 59-year-old African-American male who comes to your office for an annual exam. Past medical history, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, social history, tobacco use, 1.5 to 2 packs per day for 41 years. In terms of medications, he's on Norvasc once daily and Crestor once daily as well. JM reports he was recently diagnosed with lung cancer approximately 5 weeks ago and reports he is ready to quit now. He has tried the nicotine inhaler and the nasal spray during previous quit attempts but didn't like using those products and stated he is not interested in trying them again now. So what is your recommended pharmacotherapy option for JM today? So A, nicotine patch, 21 milligram. B, nicotine lozenge, 4 milligram. C, nicotine patch, 21 milligram daily, plus the nicotine gum when needed for cravings. And the nicotine patch, or D, nicotine patch, 21 milligram daily, plus varenicline twice daily. So when we think about each of these different options that we have, given the patient and keeping in mind some of the previous information that we highlighted about our patient, so given the patient has tried and has stated he's not interested in the inhaler, he's not interested in the nasal spray, they probably shouldn't be recommended per the patient request. He's tried them. He's not interested in retrying them again at this point. He also smokes about 1.5 to 2 packs per day. So taking a look at our initial two options, choice A, the patch by itself, or even choice B, the lozenge by itself, he's almost up to 2 packs per day. So they probably would not be providing enough nicotine in terms of decreasing those withdrawal symptoms, most likely, given his reported tobacco use. Given that, most likely the most ideal initial choice would probably be answer C. So the nicotine patch daily plus the gum when needed for cravings to try as closely match how much nicotine we're replacing compared to how much nicotine he has been using, that 1.5 to 2 packs per day. D, just to highlight, would also not be an option, and that primarily is due to that varenicline combination. Now, there have been some studies that have looked at combination therapy of varenicline for heavy smokers, but at this point, it is still only approved as a monotherapy option. So C would be the initial choice. And taking a look at our final case, case number 4. AB is a 22-year-old Hispanic female. She presents to the clinic for her annual exam. Past medical history and social history is significant for tobacco use. 1 pack per day for 8 years. Her meds include Micronor, and AB reports she is interested in quitting, but her main concern is gaining weight after she quits. So what is the recommended pharmacotherapy options for today? Well, given her main concern is weight gain, taking a look at some of our different options, we see the patch, the gum, nasal spray, as well as varenicline. It's important to reinforce both with the patch as well as the gum and bupropion all have been shown to delay weight gain. So out of our options that we have here, B or the nicotine gum 4 milligram would be the initial go-to given the patient's concerns in terms of weight gain. This provides a nice option that has been shown to delay weight gain. So to wrap us up, how can clinicians get involved? So again, I think it's something that we probably hear at many different calls, but I just thought it was valuable to reinforce that message. We certainly don't have to be the ones that are always providing the full comprehensive visit. Many of us are pulled in 1,000 different directions. You don't have to be the one to lead the full visit, but just initiating that visit, getting that visit started, getting that information out to that patient is going to be valuable. It's going to lead to an intervention for our patient. And probably one of the most beneficial approaches for the busy clinician is going to be that ask, advise, refer method. It's a great approach. It allows us to make an intervention, highlighting the importance of quitting. Even if we're not able to actually participate in the full consult, we're still able to initiate a brief visit, brief counseling with the patient, and stress the importance of quitting with our patients. So bottom line, making a commitment to our patients, addressing tobacco use with all patients at every visit, and again, asking, advising, and referring. And at this point, I will hand things over to Pat Bax.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lodis, for an excellent presentation, and it's certainly information that will assist our providers in helping their patients to quit. For those of you who are new to the call today, the New York State Smokers Quit Line, who's assisting in providing this call for you today, is a free evidence-based service that's available for tobacco users, their families, friends, and providers in New York State. Since we've started in 2000, the Quit Line, which is located at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York, has received more than 1.6 million calls. And clients can access our services through a variety of ways. They can call the Quit Line directly. They can go online to register for our free nicotine replacement therapy in the form of patches, or they can be directly referred from you, the provider. And we do offer free motivational coaching, support, a two-week supply of nicotine patches, an array of resources, as you can see on our website, and our online smoke-free community. And in addition to the 2 weeks of patches that we do offer for tobacco users, we also try to leverage our NRT with other resources. And this includes providing clients with details of low-cost medication, and we often give them information on medication discount cards, as well as through their insurance plans. When we interview our clients, we ask if they have a health plan, and if so, the Quit Coach provides them with cessation benefit information from their respective plan. And this may range from conveying a phone number to warm transferring the client to a vendor who may offer cessation benefits. So we invite you to look at all our tools, our valuable tools on our website, downloadable materials, and we have some wonderful videos that will support you in your efforts. And I'm also pleased to announce that we've recently posted our annual report for 2011, and that can be found on the Health Provider and Partner tab under Reports. And you'll find that in 2011, the Quit Line, Quit Coach, has provided coaching to more than 100,000 clients. And we distributed over 72,000 nicotine replacement therapy starter kits. And there were over 508,000 hits to our website. And other highlights you'll find in the report include tobacco facts, how we reach our underserved population, our reach and utilization, our services, client characteristics, and highlighting some of our partnerships. So if you're interested in learning more about our services or if you have any particular questions, please contact us directly at 1-866-697-8487. Thank you. And at this time, we will open it up for questions.
The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any point your question has been answered, you may press 7 again to disable your request. If you're using a speakerphone, we ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. The first question comes from Patty Jacobs. Patty?
Yes, good afternoon. My question is, if I heard you correctly, to delay weight gain, gum is recommended?
Yes, yes. So actually, so just to highlight the question to make sure everybody heard it. So in terms of the most recent one of our patient cases that we talked about, which options are available that have been shown to delay weight gain? The nicotine gum at the 4 milligram dose, nicotine lozenge can also be utilized, as well as bupropion have all been shown to delay weight gain. So if you have a patient that is coming up and being repetitive, has an issue, or that has been a concern with previous quit attempts, those would be very reasonable options to utilize. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. I had a part two to that question.
Yes.
I can flip it in real quickly. For patients that present themselves with hypertension, and I was just going through the case studies, we were giving patches. Now, my understanding and reading, individuals with high blood pressure, we would not recommend patches. Can you clarify that for me?
So in terms of a patient, so the nicotine precautions are specific to, as I mentioned, patients that are within 2 weeks of an MI, unstable angina, serious arrhythmias. The primary thought is just patients that are unstable. So if you have a patient, and just to make sure correct me if I didn't hear your question appropriately, if you have a patient that has hypertension, controlled hypertension, it is certainly appropriate to utilize a nicotine replacement therapy, for example, something like the patch. It really comes down to those three specific considerations that we just want to make sure patients are stabilized. But again, the risks of them continuing to utilize tobacco products would probably certainly far outweigh any potential risk of the nicotine replacement therapy. Is that addressing your question?
Yes, but when you say, it's just a little bit ambiguous when you say unstable. So would I consider a patient that's hypertensive that's unstable if he's on medication?
No.
Well, I would consider them unstable if they weren't controlled. So maybe uncontrolled would be a better approach. That would certainly be appropriate to utilize a nicotine replacement patch.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We have a question on the line from Sayal Diallo Pavan.
Hello. I just wanted to thank you. Dr. Leshner, again, for the excellent presentation. You're welcome. I just want to mention that we are from the New York City Health Department's Tobacco Control Program, and we're actually in the works of creating a very comprehensive online learning module that's really geared towards primary care physicians and medical residents about treating tobacco use and dependence. And I just want to let you all know that should be available around end of November or December, and we will, of course, have it on our provider page and remind everyone through our usual channels. Thank you.
We have time for one last question from Kathy Hanchak.
Hi. Is anybody still double patch out there?
So in terms of the question, in terms of utilizing double patches, it typically is not recommended. Has it been done? Has there been evidence in terms of literature, in terms of evaluating the safety of it? Yes, there is. Hasn't shown increased risk associated with it, but from a practice perspective, usually we utilize different types of combinations, as I highlighted in the presentation. So approved combinations like the patch and the gum or the patch and the inhaler, as opposed to utilizing two patches at the same time. Does that answer your question?
Hi, Matt. We use a double patch, actually, but since we use mostly Chantix with a little bit of Zyban and patch, we don't double patch at all anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, as I mentioned, it has been done, but we tend to recommend utilizing some of the other recommended combination products as well, or combination options as well. But it has been done. They have literature on it. So that's certainly, you know, from an anecdotal perspective, I'm not surprised to hear that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. Our next collaborative conference call will be on Wednesday, September 12th at 12 p.m., That call will be entitled Drug Interactions with Smoking and Smoking Cessation Medications. Our featured speaker will be Dr. Paul Oh from the University Health Network in Toronto, Ontario. And on behalf of the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program and the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I want to express our sincere appreciation for the excellent presentation today. Thank you, Dr. Lodis. And thank you, everyone else, for participating in today's call. This brings us to the end. Have a great rest of your day. Thank you.
This does conclude today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh,
this is Nicole.
Oh, hi, Nicole. Great. Oh, thank you, Nicole. I love the way you
present
it. It's so clear and your voice is, you present in such a way that keeps people's interest.
Oh, that's good. I know. I don't think we ended up mentioning to them if they wanted to email because we didn't have enough time for questions. So with that, maybe we could, I don't know if we can post something or should I just leave it?
just
let it go.
Yeah, they the participants have, like, my email, and they also have Terry's
email. Oh, perfect.
So if they do have a question.